Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. His home group is the From the Heart Speakers Group in Lancaster, PA. Please help me welcome J.D.
Put a little shelf in here. My name is J.D. Burkholder. I'm an alcoholic. And my my sobriety date is January 21st of 2003. And my home group is From the Heart Speakers Group, and we're in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And y'all are welcome to come down sometime. Some of you guys that are here, I've seen you down there a couple times. It's a group a lot like this, probably about this size. Driving up here, I did not realize this meeting had grown this much and gotten this big, and that's awesome. That's wonderful. I guess I had spoken maybe a couple years ago at the other church. But it's always an honor and privilege to be asked to come up and speak and share at an AA meeting. This program truly did give me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And hopefully tonight I'll be able to tell you guys a little bit, you know, what it was like, you know, what I was like, you know, some of my experiences drinking, most importantly how I felt inside and why I drank, and then share with you guys, you know, how this program helped me out, gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams, and share a little bit what my experience has been within the 6 years of being sober, and share with you guys the ups, the downs, you know. I remember when I first came in, you know, you sort of get, I guess, you know, you go through the 12 steps and you know, things change dramatically in your life, you know, for the good, and I see a lot of people coming out of the rooms and experience that, and then as soon as things get a little bit rocky, because, you know, life does show up, you know, things are not always perfect. In sobriety, I've made plenty of mistakes, done tons of stupid things, but thank God this program has given me, has outlined a way of life that I can correct those mistakes. And hope they'll be able to share some of those struggles with you guys, and how I've walked through some of those things. What I was taught in this program, really, you know, early on was to become transparent, you know what I mean, and let you guys know and see, like, my insides and see how I was and how I acted and share with you my faults for the sole purpose of sobriety and to help you stay sober and share with you how I've overcome some of those things. You know, being disingenuous in this program does not allow me to live, you know, happy, joyous, and free. You know, I believe I have to be genuine and like I said, share with you guys, every aspect of my life. Anyway, this is sort of a long preface. I usually start off my story, my first drink. Not so much because it's all that relevant as to why I'm an alcoholic, but more because of irony. It's pretty funny. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Actually, like 2 miles from where my home group is now. Two loving parents. They were high school sweethearts. You know, they're still happily married. Had a really good childhood. I have an older brother that's 3 years older than me. He married his high school sweetheart, you know, and they're happily married and live in Philadelphia, and they have 2 little girls. And, you know, when I was little, my granny used to watch me and my brother. And I remember, and I don't think she was an alcoholic. I mean, I don't know if she was. She passed away when I was like 7 or 8, so I really don't remember her that well. But I do remember the only thing she ever kept in her refrigerator was beer and M&M's. And it's the truth, because it's funny, because I was talking to my brother like 2 weeks ago, right? And I was sharing this story, and he remembers this story, you know, as vividly as I do. And he said the same thing. He said to me a couple weeks ago, he said, "Do you remember Granny, all she ever had was those peanut M&M's and beer in her fridge?" And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, every time I speak at a meeting, I tell the story about the peanuts and M&M's, or and cans of beer. And she'd always give us the M&M's. She'd never let me drink any of the beer, and he'd always ask for sips and stuff. She'd never give me any. And one day, she pulled out 2 cans. She handed one to me and handed one to my brother and said, "If you're man enough to open it, you're man enough to drink it." And I've always told the story that I cracked it open, I pounded my beer, and my brother took one sip, didn't like his, and I asked her if I could drink his. However, my brother has a different twist. He said that he opened it for me because I wasn't able to open it. I was 5 years old. And I drank about half of it, and she took it from me. And he said he didn't like the taste, and I asked her if I could drink his as well. So that's probably the more accurate story. It's real funny because I, you know, from early on, I liked the taste of it. I'll never forget that day. I was 5 years old. I don't remember any other day of my of being 5 years old, but I remember that day so vividly. And my brother, you know, took a sip. He didn't like the taste, and it's so ironic because I grew up and I lived a completely different, you know, style of life than my brother. You know, he got good grades. He was an all-state soccer player. He was a really, really good-looking guy. He could be, he could have had pretty much any girl he wanted in school. He was homecoming king. You know, like I said, married his high school sweetheart. I mean, enough to make you throw up. You know what I mean? It makes you want to puke. Really, I've never heard a bad thing about him. Like in Lancaster, he had tons of friends, and we had some similar friends. And I've never heard a bad thing about him. He always helped my parents out with stuff. I couldn't have asked for a better big brother. He always looked out for me. He always had my back. You know, I have no bad memories whatsoever about him, you know, and later on I'll share with you guys too, and now today, you know, me and him are real good friends, we talk all the time, but, you know, even through, you know, my alcoholism and you know, all the stealing I did from him and the pain and probably the embarrassment that I put him through, he never, you know, stopped trying to help me, you know, and I'll share a lot about that through my story, and just an excellent role model, you know, a guy that, you know, I, you know, definitely you know, try to live my life after. But anyway, so I grew up, and I was a real, real mischievous kid. I got lots of energy. I'm still really hyper. I can't sit still for longer than 5 seconds. Like up here, it'd be ideal for me if I could like pick up the mic and actually pace back and forth as I spoke. It'd probably be easier for me. You know, I got tons of, I was always like that. I couldn't sit still in class. You know. Wasn't a mean kid, wasn't really like a bully or anything, but I definitely stole things from kids, you know what I mean? You know, as a little guy, poison control, knew me by first name basis. I actually, my mom called up, it was on speed dial, she called up one time, so this is Marianne Burkholder, and they said, oh, JD's mom, that's a true story as well. I ate mothballs. I got into everything. I was a real, real mischievous, really, really curious kid. And these things, I don't think any of these things, you know, are what made me an alcoholic, you know, either. You know, a lot of it, you know, helped me, you know, have a bit of a spiritual malady, I guess. But as far as the physical allergy to alcohol and what alcohol did for me, you know, what it talks about in the big book, you know, that feeling that alcohol gave us and that compulsion to, as soon as alcohol hits my lips and, you know, goes down my throat, that I instantly, intuitively know that I need more now. You know what I mean? You know, I truly believe that that's what made me an alcoholic. And I shared with you guys my first drink when I was, I believe I was in seventh grade. And I guess prior to this, I mean, even in elementary school, I remember my friends, like, we would steal bikes from kids. I'd steal stuff out of, like, kids' lockers. We'd roll up, like, leaves and stuff and smoke them and pretend we were smoking cigarettes and stuff. And we'd try to get our hands on cigarettes. I'd steal cigars from my dad. I even remember stealing beers from my dad, but never really getting drunk, just taking sips of them. I had a propensity for criminal behavior, you know what I mean? I guess as a psychopath or whatever. I mean, I was a bad kid, you know? Like I said, nothing out of mouth. I never wanted to harm anybody or hurt anybody. I have no clue. It was, like, innate within me to cause trouble, I guess. In seventh grade, I remember one night going downstairs in my parents' basement, and I mixed a bunch of liquor. It was, like, vodka, whiskey, like, some nasty stuff. Made this little concoction, and I remember drinking it, and I just remember I liked the taste, like, and that's nasty, you know what I mean? Like, I like that alcohol taste. I like the feeling of it going down, you know. I like that warm, like, tightness come over my shoulders, you know, looking back, it wasn't, I don't think, like, I was, you know, a real, real troubled kid and I was drinking to escape anything. I mean, I was just drinking out of curiosity. And when I found that, like, as soon as I took a couple sips and I started to feel that feeling, like, I intuitively knew that I needed more now. And I drank more and made another little concoction. And I ended up getting pretty drunk. And I remember I called up this girl. I told her how much I liked her. I told her all these things I wanted to do to her. And my parents never called me. I guess I had gone to bed. I don't remember much past that. I guess I had just gone upstairs and gone to bed. and the next day went to school. And it literally, it was like that, that like things changed for me. I remember, you know, I played sports. I was a pretty good soccer player. I always, you know, I was a pretty good athlete growing up. I loved sports. I got decent grades, you know. And I remember, like, after experiencing that, like, I wanted to feel like that all the time. I'm an extremely, extremely excessive person. I'm sure nobody here can relate to that whatsoever. But I am, like, I am extremely excessive. Like, when I find something that I like and something that makes me feel good, I want to experience it all the time. You know what I mean? I mean, whether that's relationships, whether that's, you know, hobbies, sports, alcohol, whatever. You know, you name it. But at this time of my life, it happened to be booze, you know? And from that curiosity and from that feeling, you know, experiencing that feeling, I sought out people that they drank and they did other things. And I got involved with other things. Drugs are definitely a part of my story. I'll limit my, you know, talking about that because I do believe, you know, primary purpose is alcoholism is for the alcoholic. And, you know, there's a lot of byproducts from my alcoholism, you know, using women, cheating, lying, stealing, drugs, you know, all that stuff comes along with it for me. You know, going through school, like I said, you know, I started hanging out with like kids that partied a lot and drank. I started you know, selling some of these things. I grew up in Lancaster City and I went to the city schools, and it's funny looking back at the school that I went to. Really, anybody, and it might sound funny because I knew a lot of the suburban schools weren't really like this, but like anybody who was anybody pretty much hustled at my school. Like, that's kind of how it was. If you weren't partying or you weren't like selling drugs, then you really weren't anybody. You know what I mean? And that was just the reality of the school district I went to. I mean, it really was. You know, I started hanging out with kids like that. I started getting involved, you know, with stuff like that. I've always been kind of a different kid. Like, all my friends growing up in schools were pretty much like thugs, and I somehow was like into skateboarding and into the Grateful Dead. And nobody else, none of my other friends were. My homeroom teacher had actually got me into the Grateful Dead, believe it or not. You know, and I don't know why, it seems to be, you know, something that's pretty consistent within my life is whatever group I'm hanging out with, I always try to be different than you. Instead of being a part of and fitting in, I really don't know why that is, but I always like to be unique and be a little bit different. You know, just a part of my ego and that, you know, conscious separation from, you know, and you know, growing up, and I always did feel different from you guys and separate. And, you know, so I, you know, obviously I start getting in a lot of trouble. My parents start kicking me out of the house. Around eighth grade, I got diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome. I don't yell stuff. I twitch. I have, like, different motor tics. I'll blink my eyes, like, a million times. If I'm watching an Eagles game, it goes berserk. Or in any stressful situation. During adolescence, in junior high and high school, it was a little bit worse. Like, I had some pretty bizarre motor tics. Thank God I didn't yell stuff, you know. I got sent down to Johns Hopkins Medical Center, and I got evaluated by a group of psychologists, and I was diagnosed, you know, with the Tourette syndrome and bipolar. And I had a lot of stuff going on. I mean, I had hit my mom a couple times. I was somewhat violent kid. I was just a real troubled kid. And the truth was, for me, how I felt was the most important thing in the world. And I was so extremely, I should even say by default, I am so extremely selfish and self-centered. You know, a complete opportunist, you know what I mean? Like, I will rob from you, I will steal from you as long as it makes me feel better. I found that actually these 12 steps in this program in AA has become a solution to so many different areas of my life. And I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But even for my Tourette syndrome, like when I'm really active in AA and I'm helping guys and I'm practicing these principles, like I don't even really have tics that much. I get put on, you know, I was a fairly heavily medicated child, And I resented my parents so much for that. You know what I mean? I really did. I was so resentful about that. And the truth was, they just loved me to death, and they couldn't figure out, you know, what was wrong with their kids. You know, why am I hitting my mom? Like, why won't I ever listen to them? Why are they finding, like, lots of money in my bedroom, you know what I mean? Because I'm participating in, you know, some extracurricular activities, I guess. And they just want the best for me, you know? And you know, I resent them for it. I don't take the medication at all, and I did for a little bit, but horrible side effects, and I stopped taking it, and all of a sudden I stopped getting good grades and getting kicked out of my parents' house, and eventually, it's around right before I turned 17, I ended up leaving home, and I had like dreadlocks down to here, and all through high school I weighed about 120 pounds, I was pretty little, and I left home, and started pretty much hitchhiking around the country, and followed like the Grateful Dead and different bands around. And started hanging out with street kids, like in New York City, Portland, Oregon, and we'd hitchhike all over the place. Real interesting couple years of my life. Did and participate in lots of really, really crazy stuff. A lot of it I really don't remember. You know, bounced in and out of jails and institutions and accumulated warrants across the country, still some of which I'm in the midst of trying to take care of. You know, just a lot of insanity, you know, and it's funny because I really did believe this, you know, I was just delusional that I really thought I was only hurting myself. And I used to always, you know, say to my parents, if you just leave me alone, let me live my life and do my thing. And, you know, and I really believed it, and I think a lot of it's because I had such a low self-opinion. Like, I had absolutely like, no self-worth whatsoever. And I just don't think I could really even fathom somebody really cared about me that much. Do you know what I mean? And looking back on it, I see how insane and how delusional that is. You know, my parents, my mom's a school teacher. My dad had started a business around this time. They don't know where their 17-year-old son is. You know, I know my mom had told me later on that she had found like a couple dirty needles, I guess, in my bedroom around this time. And I can't even fathom. I have two dogs, right? My dog got hit by a car 4 months ago, and I was devastated. Like, you know what I mean? I was beat up at the fact that my dog got hit by a car. I couldn't imagine if I had a kid that was 17, and all I found were some dirty needles in the room, and he's gone. I have no clue where he is, you know? And they had to wake up every morning and go to work and, you know, go to bed at night. And I just can't imagine that, you know what I mean? I can't imagine the pain I put them through. So, you know, that's what I'm doing, and hitchhiking around the country and getting in trouble and stuff, and I get arrested down in Tennessee, like 2 weeks after my 18th birthday. I hadn't talked to my parents in a real long time. Went to jail. When I went to jail, I weighed 107 pounds. I'll never forget that. I remember stepping on the scale and just thinking, man, like, that can't be right, you know. That is small, man, 107 pounds. And I had all kinds of head lice. It was real, real dirty. Real, real dirty kid. Like, real, real dirty. Never bathed. So I went to jail and detoxed, and I think it was about a week into it, I called my parents, of course, you know, last resort, and asked them to bail me out. And my mom came down, bailed me out of jail, and, you know, I told her if she did that I would go to rehab. And went to my first rehab. And now I had gone... When I was 16, I got arrested, I think, for some weed or something, and I had gone to had taken some drug and alcohol classes, counseling or whatever, you know, for getting in trouble. So this was the second time that I had been introduced to AA. But I remember when I was 16 and I was going to these classes, I'll never forget that there were these two guys in there, and they would pretty much, it was kind of like a scared straight type thing. Like, I don't really remember how much recovery they actually talked about, but they talked a lot about... you know, the progression of their alcoholism. And I remember they would look right at me. And I remember being in that class and those guys telling me, you know, exactly what was going to happen in my life and where I was going to be. And I remember looking at them thinking they are absolutely out of their minds, that would never happen to me, you know. And looking back in hindsight, my life went exactly like that, you know what I mean? It's almost like today now, like when I'm sponsoring a guy, and he all of a sudden comes up with a better idea or a better plan for his life, you know? And I'm looking at him, I'm telling him, like, dude, I know exactly what's going to happen, you know, in the next couple years in your life if you take that path. and no, and they'll go and do it, and I'll literally watch their lives go exactly how I saw it happening, you know, and this is how my life was, you know, and I end up in this rehab, and I'm looking back, and I'm thinking about that stuff, and I knew sitting in that rehab that I didn't want to weigh 107 pounds, you know what I mean? I knew I didn't want to, you know, have head lice and you know, live on the streets, and I remember being in there, and I remember hearing this, hearing the counselors talk about AA and talk about recovery, and they kept talking about this recovery house in Florida, and I kept fighting it. And my thing was, at all these rehabs I go to, I would never be willing to quit drinking. You know what I mean? It was like that was the first thing that I really experienced any sort of freedom from. You know, the other things, you know, some of those harder drugs and things, I was willing to put that stuff down, but I was never willing to put the booze down. Somehow I agreed to go, you know, they got me to agree to go to a halfway house in Florida, and I had this grandiose idea that it was going to be like right on the beach, and there was going to be all these women everywhere. Not like any woman would have wanted to have anything to do with me at this point in my life whatsoever anyway. But, you know, I had this grandiose idea, and I go down there, and it's on the other side of the train tracks, like right next to the train tracks, and it was, you know, real dirty place, whatever, I mean, it was a recovery house, whatever, I mean, you know what I mean, what's it going to be? And I got all pissed off, and I left, and I hitchhiked home, because I had a better plan. You know, my plan was I was going to go back to high school. I was going to, you know, rent an apartment with my friend Alex, you know, and I was going to, you know, work a job at this pizza shop, Antonio's. That's what I did. Never went to school. You know, signed up for school again, never really went to school. You know, was drinking like crazy and started getting involved with some of those harder things again with my buddy Alex. And it was short-lived, you know what I mean? Like all my plans. And it's funny because when we get sober, like some of our plans, they'll sound so virtuous. You know what I mean? Like they'll sound like the best ideas to even normal people. They're like, that's a great idea. You know, be responsible, get an apartment, go back to school. JD's probably going to be okay. You know what I mean? To my parents, that looked like a good idea. To everybody but the other alcoholics that were in the rehab and the counselors that were telling me it was a horrible idea. But to normal people, those things look like good ideas. But see, the alcoholic, we're so delusional, you know what I mean, that we will convince ourselves, at least I will, I'll speak for myself, I can convince myself of anything, absolutely anything, being a good idea. I almost convinced myself in sobriety that taking steroids would be a good idea. It's absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. I didn't do it, but I almost convinced myself of it. I've almost convinced myself of so many stupid things. Thank God I have a sponsor and I have people that are close to me in sobriety to keep me grounded. So I start doing that, and I wind up back on the streets again, lose my apartment, all that stuff, and I leave town, I start hitchhiking around the country again, and do that, you know, that same stuff, following different bands around, hanging out with street kids and gutter punks, living in, you know, lived in New York City for a little while, Portland, Oregon for a little while, Colorado, Missouri, and like I said, just got in a lot of trouble, did some real, real grimy stuff, you know, just living like a complete animal, really, you know. On good days, you know, if the hustle was good, we could get a hotel room and stay in there. In bad days, we'd just sleep in the park or whatever, you know what I mean? And that's just how it went for a while. And the crazy thing is that I chose that to be my life. It wasn't like my parents were like, get out of here, don't come back. If I ever wanted to go home, they would have taken me in, you know what I mean? That's insane. That's absolutely insane. I chose to live like a complete animal. Had a great upbringing, you know what I mean? Had every opportunity available, you know? But I chose to live like that. You know, and the truth was I couldn't stand myself so much that, like, I had to be in a complete oblivion all the time. Like, just getting a little bit drunk, you know what I mean, or just drinking a little bit here and there just didn't suffice. Like, for me, it got to the point, and I think it happens to most of us, that it gets to that point where the best we have is oblivion. You know, when you first start drinking, and, like that night I went in the basement, and I finally called that girl up and told her how much I liked her. And then there'd be a couple other nights you'd have at the beginning, those nights where you'd go to that party, you'd say just the right thing, everybody would laugh, you know, all these people wanted to be your friend, like, it was just the perfect, absolutely perfect night, you had the perfect feeling, you just got to that spot, you know what I mean? And then what happens is, it's like, you keep trying to chase that, you keep trying to have that night over and over and over again, and they become fewer and further between, you know? And it got to a certain point in my life that the best I had was oblivion, you know, was where I just drank and drank and drank to the point that I couldn't feel anything and I passed out, you know, and then when I wake up, you know, that feeling of incomprehensible demoralization, you know what I mean, you're just like, oh God, I got to do this again, and I'm sure you guys have heard this, that description of being like Groundhog Day, that movie Groundhog Day with Bill Murray or whatever. And that's exactly what it was, you know. You know, my brother had contacted me, and I guess I'd talked to him one night, and I was all messed up and called him asking for some help, I moved. He offered for me to move down to Virginia. He was going to college down in Virginia to be with his girlfriend. And here's another thing. He went to Pitt, and he was going to play soccer for Pitt, and then I believe he was going to be a field goal kicker, too, for the football team, right? But instead, he wanted to go with his girlfriend, so he goes to Eastern Mennonite University down in Harrisonburg, Virginia. That doesn't even make any sense. But he loved, you know what I mean? He loved his girl, and they're happily married today. He lives a great life, so obviously made the right decision. But a guy like me, you know, I'd go for the ego-fulfilling, you know, opportunity, obviously. Anyways, he's living in Virginia, allows me to move down there. I go down there, and I detox, and his friends, you know, he has a couple college roommates, and you know what? They would smoke weed occasionally, like once in a blue moon, and they drink every now and then. Typical like college stuff, you know. But that was it, you know. And I moved down there, and I'm detoxing the couch. And I remember the first day I'm down there, his roommates come down, and they're looking at me, and I'm like, you know, I'm just a mess. And they're looking at me like I have six heads. They never seen anything like that. And I had a rough time, man. Like down there, like I remember the first couple weeks, I almost killed myself a couple times, But I never really had the courage to be able to actually follow through with it. Obviously, so I'm standing here today. And I remember being down there. Once I started feeling a little bit better, I went out to look for a job. And it's amazing how the alcoholic can, it's like I gravitated towards like a certain place. And the first place I go fill out an application is this place called Luigi's Pizza Shop. And now Harrisonburg, Virginia, James Madison University is down there as well. And I go to this pizza shop, fill out an application, and it happened to be owned by these three guys that were in their 40s that finished college and never really wanted to grow up. They just wanted to own this pizza shop and drink and party the rest of their lives. And they hired me instantly, you know, and it was all you could drink, Natty Light and Budweiser, while you worked. I made $5.25 an hour, but all you could drink, Natty Light and Budweiser. Still to this day, one of the best jobs I ever had in my life. But at this point in my life, man, I was sort of at that spot where, like, I had just completely lost myself. You know what I mean? Like, I had no clue who I was, what I was about. I had no principles. I stood for nothing. I was a shell of a man. You know what I mean? Like, I remember just feeling absolutely worthless. When I get to that point and I feel like I have nothing, like, the last bit of control that I have is to try to act like a tough guy and try to fight everybody when I get drunk, you know what I mean? And that didn't work out so well for me either. So I'm down there, and they would be entertained, the owners, by getting me drunk all the time. I made a couple friends down there, but eventually they stopped wanting, you know, to take me anywhere. You know, I would always get in fights, and I would always run my mouth, and I was just a complete mess. And I remember at night, when I wasn't working, I mean, I actually liked to work because then I could be around people. When I wasn't, I was back at my brother's house, and I would go buy Steel Reserves, the 22-ounce Steel Reserves. I don't know if anybody drank. It's my favorite beer. It's like $1.25. You open it, smells like somebody farted in the room, and it's like 9.9% alcohol, but they'll get you twisted. So I would drink Steel Reserves all the time, and I'd just sit there, and I'd drink Steel Reserves, and I would sit there and like cry to myself. I mean, just absolutely pathetic, man. I would drink and drink and drink and could never get to that point where I felt okay. And the best I had was, like I said, oblivion when I just passed out. You know, so maybe the Steel Reserves would get you to that point. And I'm down there, and like I said, man, I was just in a real, real dark spot. Swearing that I was never going back to that other stuff because the other stuff was my problem. And I was convinced that by just drinking, things would get better. And they wouldn't, you know what I mean? And I would drink and drink and drink. And like I said, you know, the best I had got was, you know, passing out. And girls, no girls wanted to have anything to do with me. And I had no rap for them whatsoever this period of my life, that's for sure. You know, I was always looking at people's shoes, couldn't look anybody in the eyes. But I knew that Harrisonburg is the problem, so I moved back up to Lancaster and started hanging out with my old buddies, you know, I grew up with, and you know, same crap. I'll spare you the whole, you know, story of that, but same stuff, you know, same thing, just different place. And that was, you know, very consistent in my life as well, is moving, just always moving to a different spot, thinking things are going to be different. And we all know, you know, I follow myself wherever I go, and I'm obviously the problem. So I'm in Lancaster, and up to this point, I have bounced in and out of so many different rehabs and detoxes throughout the country. It was ridiculous, and like I said, I had now accumulated different warrants and things, like the stuff in Tennessee I never took care of, some stuff in Portland, Oregon, and stuff like that, and just a bunch of crap. And I'm in Lancaster, and I actually got 12-stepped by a friend of mine smoking a blunt out on the porch of the party. That's a true story. And what happened was he had gotten sober up in New York in another fellowship, and moved back to Lancaster and relapsed, and he happened to be at this party the one night, and I go outside and he's out there and smoking away, and I remember looking at him and asking him, you know, what it was like when he was clean and he was sober, and I think he had 6 months, and he looked at me, and in a real genuine way he said, you know what, he said, that was the happiest I ever was, and he's like, I wish I'd have never moved back here. And literally the next day I packed up my stuff and I went to rehab. And I went to White Deer Run in Allenwood. If you're playing, people have probably been there. If they're in here. I'd been there before. And you know, something was different this time. For the first time in my life, like, I was willing to put down everything. Like, I realized, like, alcohol was a problem for me. You know what I mean? Like, I cannot drink. And I go into this rehab. You know, I'm not one of those guys going like a rehab or get sober and just start talking a lot, you know what I mean, or be like the rehab, like, top guy. Like, I'm a pretty depressing dude, you know what I mean? Like, I'll go in there and I can't talk to anybody, I can't look at anybody, I smell like BO the whole time, you know what I mean? I sweat profusely, you know, I'm just nervous and scared, and I'll try to act like I'm tough, you know, nobody's scared of me, I'm weighing like 110, 20 pounds or whenever I'm in there, and I'm in there, and I won't really talk to anybody. I'll try to act like I'm mean or whatever, and I don't know, whatever. So I go in there, and I knew that I had to quit. I had to, you know, quit doing some of the, you know, quit drinking and everything. And I get my counselor, and I fill out all the workbook stuff. You know what I mean? And like, I'm ready to get sober. You know, they send me to this halfway house in Pottstown, Creative Health it was called, and I get in there, and I start going to AA meetings, and I get a sponsor, and I call them maybe once a week, you know, I never really start working any steps, and I make two real close friends, you know, and that's it. I don't want to talk to everybody else, you know what I mean, I got to act like I'm tough, I don't want to be friends with them, whatever, and I'm just a mess, man. You know what I mean? I remember feeling like so terrified of everybody and anything. You know, I didn't want to talk to anybody from my hometown. I really didn't want to go out that much because, again, like, I would just look at the ground. I'd get so nervous. I had such social anxiety. You know, if a girl came near me, I'd sweat profusely. I was just a real, real scared, real, real terrified kid. I had real, real low self-opinion. I thought I was the dumbest, ugliest person in the world, you know what I mean? I just felt like absolutely nothing. And it's funny because, you know, when we first start drinking, I think, like, most kids, like normal people, like in adolescence, I think it's pretty awkward. Like, you learn how to make friends, you start liking girls, like all that stuff. You learn how to date, you know what I mean? You learn certain social skills. And I'm sure it's, you know, scary and a little bit terrifying, you know, at that age. But when you're an alcoholic like me and you start drinking early on like that, like, that's how I dealt with all that stuff. Like, as soon as I got drunk, I could be the life of the party. I was real social. I could deal with people. I could talk to girls. Never had a problem making friends growing up. You know what I mean? And then at a certain point, like, when the alcohol's not working, when I get to that point where the best I have is oblivion, you know what I mean? And I cause so much damage to other people throughout their life. Sorry, whoever's so, or particularly it is. I cause so much damage, you know, and do so many things to other people that all that stuff builds in my subconscious that I have this horrible low self-opinion that even the alcohol can't hide. When I get sober for the first time, man, all that stuff comes about, and I have no clue how to deal with people. I have no clue how to communicate. Like, I'm just lost, and I'm scared, and that's how I was. And give me no other solution, you know what I mean? Take away the booze from me and offer me nothing else. Like, or I guess I should say it was offered to me, but I wasn't willing to try anything else. You know, that's a scary spot to be in. And for me, you know, I lasted about 3 months. And I really believed this. I thought that it was time. I really thought that the alcohol was the problem. Like, as soon as I put that down, it's going to be uncomfortable and awkward for a little while, but give it time, and I'll bounce back, and things, you know what I mean, and things will start to become normal again, and I can be like all the normal people I see out in the rest of the world, you know, like my parents and my brother. And what happens is, over time, it's like it gets worse and worse, and like the incessant, like, negative, like, thoughts, like, will not stop that racing, you know what I mean, inside my head. And the insecurity is just getting worse and worse, and I'm just absolutely terrified, man. And I can't figure out that, okay, I'm finally not drinking, like, why aren't things getting any better for me now, you know? And that's scary. And I really think back on, you know, going to Johns Hopkins Medical Center and having, you know, bipolar, and I start to use that, you know, I start to justify what, you know, why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling, you know, and I start to say, well, maybe it's because, you know, I have all these different disorders, you know what I mean, and I'm different than you, and it's going to, I'm going to be depressed most of my life, and I'm going to need to take lots of Paxil, because I took lots of Paxil, you know, this, when I was clean this time, and eventually, you know, I just can't take it anymore, and I drive into town, and I relapse, and when I relapsed, it was like, whew, you know what I mean? It was great relief. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, that first relapse felt so good, man. It was like, oh, my head stopped for a little while. I felt that sense of ease and comfort that, you know, that came. But once again, you know, I know what's coming after that. You know what I mean? I know that I'll probably end up in a month or so, end up going to jail and have to detox in jail. That's always been a good motivator for me. And when I was going to these meetings, I do remember people in there talking about the 12 steps, and I remember seeing the 12 steps. And I remember there were guys in there that talked about God, and they talked about sponsorship, and they talked about those 12 steps, all those things that I didn't really think I needed to do, you know? And the one thing about AA is it really does ruin your drinking, because when I'm out there, before AA, I could justify why I did things, because I had this problem, I had this disorder, you know what I mean, I'm just not like you people, blah, 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 all just complete lies that I actually believed. But what AA did is, there were guys in there, and they talked about themselves feeling the way I had felt my whole life, that emptiness, that something just was missing, and that when I wasn't drinking, I was just always bored, and I was uncomfortable, my body hurt, like I was restless, irritable, discontented. And, you know, never heard a normal person or a counselor really talk about anything like that before. And when these guys would share that, they'd then back that up with how they were living the day, and how they had gone through the 12 steps, and how they were giving a life beyond their wildest dreams, and how they were sponsoring guys, and blah, 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 and how they had careers and everything else. And it sort of smashed that delusion, you know what I mean? It allowed me to see that, you know what, maybe there is another life out there for me, you know what I mean? Maybe there are some possibilities. And so when I'm out there, on the street again, I decide to go back into a rehab. And I go back in. And I get this counselor, and she says the most profound thing to me at the time. And I stayed sober off of this idea for 11 months. Here we go. She said, she looked at me and she said, "You, no matter what, you never have to drink or do drugs again." I was like, wow, I don't have to, no matter what. As hard as it gets, you know, I know it sounds, it's such a profound statement. And I remember thinking, no matter how hard it gets, like, I had really accepted that as my life. Like, I was okay with that. Like, I didn't want to live that life, you know, I didn't want to drink that badly that I was willing to, like, go through some struggles and be in a lot of pain and just grin and bear it and, you know, white knuckle sobriety and go through some of that stuff just so I can be a somewhat productive member of society, you know. And I get out and I go to a different fellowship and I start going to lots of meetings and I'm on, you know, some psych meds and stuff and I'm living at my parents' house and nothing really changed, you know what I mean? But there were two real important things that happened to me that allowed me to stay sober for 11 months. And wrap this up quick. But and that was, I got a job as a mason laborer, you know, working scale jobs, making making $35 an hour. You know, it's way overpaid for what I was qualified to do. I have no education whatsoever, or had none. And I met a girl, you know. And a girl, I'll tell you what, a girlfriend, that'll keep you sober for a little while. That will work for a little bit. It really will. For a guy like me, making decent money that I can spend all the time, you know, that I don't have to worry to think about myself, and a girlfriend that can fill me with all sorts of delusional thoughts about myself and tell me how great I am and how nice I am and how I'm good looking and all these things that she was completely lying about, you know what I mean? And I found a real good codependent one too, trust me. I like what Tom Flynn was with that two ticks and no dog. It's so good. And that's what it was. Like, we just sucked the life. She was actually a good girl. I mean, probably pretty codependent. She didn't drink or do drugs or anything like that. Like, she was clean. She was like 18. I was 21 or whatever. And we just sucked the life out of each other. You know what I mean? And at a certain point, you know, and literally, I was with her 24/7. It's the only time I could feel good. You know what I mean? Is when I was with her. And what would happen, though, is unfortunately in the morning I'd have to wake up and I'd have to go to work for 8 hours without her, and I couldn't put her in a little backpack and take her with me, you know, so I had to go to this job and I just couldn't take it anymore. You know, after about 9 months, I was at this, just in a real, real dark spot. It was like, how could this be? Like, I felt pretty good for a little while, like when I first started dating her and things, and then it was like just everything just started falling apart. I didn't want to work anymore. I was really lethargic. Like, I had no ambition. I had no drive. I was miserable. To the outside world, to my parents' friends and to my parents, they'd look at Jay. He's got this nice girlfriend. He's got this good job. Like, he's never going to drink again. You know? This is the most normal people they don't understand, you know? And me, I'm sitting here, I got all this stuff. I'm thinking, I hate my job. You know what I mean? My girlfriend's getting on my nerves now. You know what I mean? And the money, I wish I made more money. You know, if I made this much, things would be okay. And I was just absolutely miserable, you know, just dying inside, you know. And I go to the work every day, and I'd look down off the building, and I would think, you know, man, like, well, you know, what's the point? I'd think about suicide every day. Eventually, you know, it got to that point where it was kill yourself or relapse, you know. And then I went and I relapsed, and again, I had great relief, you know. I had a friend that he had 3 years clean and had relapsed about 3 months prior to my relapse and got sober, moved up to York, Pennsylvania, got a sponsor, started working the 12 steps in AA. I had lunch with him about a month prior to my relapse, and he was sharing with me about how he was, you know, helping guys, and he had gone through the 12 steps, and he was doing this and that. I'm thinking, well, dude, like, went through the 12 steps in 2 months or whatever, and like, you know, and I just didn't believe him, you know what I mean? And I'm like, whatever. And I remember there was something different, though. You know when somebody's experienced this way of life, like, there is something different in the eyes, you know what I mean? Like, as alcoholics, we're so used to living like animals, and then we become really intuitive, you know what I mean? Like, we know if somebody's like feeding us a line or not. And when I had that lunch, like, I knew there was something different with him. And when I was back out there and I relapsed and on the streets and stuff, I remembered him, and I went back to this rehab again. I remember my mom, I called her, she picked me up, and she's giving me a ride, and she said, you know, she looks at me, you know, outside of the hospital, and she said, "You ready?" And I was like, "Yeah, like, I'm ready, I'm used to it, you know." And my mom looks at me and she's like, "Yeah, but hopefully someday it won't have to be." You know, and I'll never forget that, because I remember thinking, like, I had accepted that as my life. Like, I really thought that it was just going to be like that. It was hard to be JD. You know what I mean? I really thought that. Like, I thought every now and then I'm going to relapse. I'll just pick myself back up and go back into the rooms and try hard again. You know, and it's amazing when I look back on it and see what my life is today and such low self-opinion I had of myself. Like, I didn't ever think I could ever, like, be successful in anything. I never thought I could have, like, you know, I just couldn't foresee anything that positive in my future. So I go into this rehab and I get this counselor, Jack Van Wyck, who absolutely loved this guy. Just real charismatic, just real, real likable guy, and he will hit you with doses of the truth that hurt so bad. Like, he just has no, he does not care who's his friend. Like, he would just tell you the truth about yourself. You know, and he'd always say the truth will set you free. You know, and that has been, you know, one of the most, you know, profound things that I've found in my life is the truth, you know, setting me free. And I remember having this counselor, and he told me, he looked at me, and I just step working God, and I told him how I was going to work the steps and all the things I was going to do, and I was going to move him with this girl again. I had all these plans and ideas, And he took the little Hazelden workbook I had, he threw it in the trash, he handed me a big book, and he told me the reason I can't stay sober is because I'm still a taker, and that I go to meetings looking to what I can get out of them instead of what I can offer. And he said, you need to take these steps, and you need to go through these steps quickly, you know. And he took me through the first three steps in that rehab, and he was the first guy I heard talk about alcohol being my solution, not my problem. And man, when he said that, I was ready to hear that, because that made so much sense. Because I thought about all those times that I relapsed, that I was clean, you know, and when I relapsed, I got that great relief, you know. And he told me, he said, now you put down this solution, because that solution has too many consequences. He says, we have to find another solution, and that's these 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he called up that buddy of mine. He didn't care about his job, you know, because you can't call and tell people somebody's in a rehab, you know what I mean, you get fired. Jack could have cared less. He called up this kid. He told him I was in the rehab. He told me what halfway house I was going to in York. He told him to pick me up that night and take me to a meeting. And this guy came, picked me up, took me to a meeting, young people's in York, and met this guy that became my first sponsor. Did one of the hardest things I had to do in sobriety, and that was ask another man for help. You know, it's like Scott Stevenson gives it. Scott Stevenson, I think he tells the best description of asking somebody to sponsor him. He says it's like asking out a girl for the first time or whatever, you know. And I remember asking this guy to sponsor me, and he looks at me. He says, "I'd be honored." And I thought he had heard about me. Like, I thought my buddy Scott had talked about me. He's like, "Well, he's honored to sponsor me." So far from the truth. It's ridiculous. That was not why he was honored, you know. And he told me someday when I start helping guys, I'll understand why he was honored. And today I can tell you I absolutely, completely understand that. And he took me through the steps, and he took me through the steps quickly. I remember on that... that fourth step, obviously there were things on there, or the fifth step, there were some things on there that I didn't want to share with anybody, especially from my past and like hitchhiking around and living in the streets. Lots of real shady, crazy stuff, you know, took place. And I had some things on there that I was never, ever going to tell anybody, you know, and I was uncomfortable with it. And I remember I shared it with them. First my buddy actually shared some of his nevers, and then I ended up sharing my nevers with my sponsor. I remember afterwards, like, I didn't have that experience where I was like, oh, like, everything was blissful and good after that. Like, I was a little uncomfortable. I was like, man, I don't know if I should have shared some of that stuff with that guy, you know. And about a week later, there was this kid in my halfway house, this kid, or recovery house, and he told me he was working on his fourth step. And he told me he was uncomfortable about some stuff. And literally, man, I do not know where it came from. Because by default, I'm not that willing to help you. I'm just not, you know what I mean? You know, I looked at him and I shared some stuff, some of these nevers that, you know, a week prior to that, I was taking to my grave. You know, I was never going to share this. And now I shared with one person, and now I shared with the second person. And I shared with him some of these nevers. And he looks at me, and he shared his nevers then with me. And it was like, at that point in my life is when this program really started to make sense to me. You know, from that moment on, I have been completely and totally free from those things. I can honestly say to you people, I do not have a single secret, you know what I mean? Like, there isn't anything in my life that I wouldn't, somebody wanted to pull me up, you know, it's not appropriate to talk about here, obviously, but wanted to pull me aside and find out what some of that stuff was, and that's going to help you, I will share it with absolutely anybody, and I'll have no problem. And I can honestly say I have yet to do a fifth step, and I've done a lot of them with guys, that anybody has, you know, worse stuff than I got on there. I got some, you know, weird and messed up stuff on there. both. And at that point it was like when I first took that drink, you know what I mean, how the world just sort of made sense to me. It was like at that point, you know, like this program in recovery made sense to me. Like the idea of doing things for people and not telling them about it. And that was something that my sponsor, you know, told me to do early on. Like that started to make sense to me. And the need to go and make those amends with people, that started to make sense to me. And it really sort of backed up what I was saying previously about, you know, becoming transparent and like sharing with you my wounds, you know, for the sole purpose of sobriety. You know what I mean? That seems to be, in my experience, the most powerful thing in this program. You know, and I've learned to have no problem doing it. You know, not be too proud. Or I don't have to become like a big shot guy in AA and, you know, do everything right. Do stupid stuff, and I've done dumb stuff, you know, in recovery. That is for sure. But I continue to try to practice these principles and continually try to pass it on to other guys. You know, You know, and I go through the 12. I went through the 12 steps and made amends. And for the first 2 years of staying sober, you know, I went to a meeting every single night, and I worried nothing. Only thing I worried about was picking guys up, taking them to meetings. Wasn't really worrying a whole lot about, you know, females. You know, I really like was really 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 active with this program, and some things happened. Like, I lived in a couple different apartments, and each apartment kept getting better and better, and I didn't look for anything. It just kind of fell into my lap. My job. I come in here, I have no, literally, like, I have got a ninth grade education. You know, eventually I ended up getting my GED. But I, you know, always worked construction, was pretty much a laborer. And, you know, I start working for a contractor that was friends with my dad. And this guy is one of the best people I know. I mean, he taught me how to be ethical. He taught me how to bid work. He taught me how to treat people with respect. I mean, he's one of the best human beings I've met. And God just completely put this guy in my life. He's a real, real religious, spiritual guy. He's not judgmental. Literally one of the best people I've ever met. And he taught me how to bid work. He basically gave me a business. And next thing you know, I have a construction business where I design and build, like, higher-end kitchens, bathrooms, additions, and things like that. You know, nothing that I went out and said, hey, I'm a smart guy. I'm going to write this business plan and, you know, start all this up. No, it just fell into my lap. Do you know what I mean? And literally, I'm not that smart of a guy, you know what I mean? Like, things just fell into my lap. And, you know, I'll try to make this, you know, fairly quick here, really, like 2 minutes. But of course, like many alcoholics, you know, you get all these good things. You know, I start having different relationships and stuff, you know, and obviously start to get distracted, you know. Don't need to go to as many meetings, you know, and, you know, I'm running my life, you know, and my life's pretty good. You're running my life. What happens is work starts to get slow, you know what I mean? Girlfriend's getting on my nerves, of course, you know. I'm judging all you people, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, I need to find some sort of something else. Like, I'm not a religious guy or anything, but I'm thinking, I need to find a church where I can find some real principled people. You know, just nonsense, complete. I mean, when I'm probably the most, like, non-principled person there out of the group of people, you know, and just completely delusional, and it was like all at once. It's like God, and I slowly stopped believing in God too. I started to intellectualize this thing. I thought I was too smart for God. It's ridiculous. I'm not that smart. You know, and what happened is a bunch of stuff started not working my way. You know, going the way I wanted it to, and you hit this wall, and it was. And then I went through some stuff and talked to my sponsor about it, and wasn't the nicest to, you know, to some girls in relationships, and he said, it's funny, he said, you become into sobriety, and we realize that we can't manage our lives drinking. So we stop drinking, our lives get real good. Then we start to manage our lives again. Like, and then we hit this other point in sobriety where our lives, for a lot of us, become a disaster, and we realize, and it becomes real scary, because that's when we truly realize that we can't manage our lives at all, period, you know, and when he said that to me, you know, it made so much sense, and instantly I started to get active again, made another, you know, did a little fist dip, made an amends list, finally I'm cleaning up some of those things that I have in Portland, Oregon, and Tennessee, you know, made some amends with people, and called the gatehouse, which is a halfway house by my house, and said, hey, look, my name's JD, you know, here's my number, put up on the board, you guys need rides for meetings. Started picking guys up, taking them to meetings. And literally like that, all of a sudden, I started to get busy again. I started to have work, but didn't do any marketing, you know, just kind of fell into my lap. I started to feel comfortable in my own skin again. And I started to build that relationship, you know, with God again. And it's just, it's so amazing how time and time again, you know, as human beings, it's not really that rational to look at those 12 steps and say, oh, yeah, that'll solve all the problems in my life. Let me go do that. You know what I mean? Like, normal people would not do that. But I go through some pain. It becomes a great motivator. I practice these principles, and then my life starts to make sense again. And it just really is such a beautiful program. Like I said about the Tourette's thing and some of the depression things, when I'm living this way of life, like, I literally don't have tics at all. Like, but when I'm really stressed out and not, like, I'll blink my eyes like a madman and just have weird tics and things. But I'm going to wrap it up because I went a minute over. This, you know, truly is, you know, the most beautiful experience I've had in my life. And if you're new in here, you know, find somebody that has the shiny eyes, as corny as that sounds, ask them to sponsor you, go through those 12 steps quickly, and start living this way of life, man. It is absolutely available for anybody. Thank you guys for having me up.
Before we close, I want to thank J.D. for sharing his experience with us tonight. And before we close, we have two group member anniversaries we want to acknowledge. Veronica?
Hi, my name's Kim and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
Hi, we have a two-year anniversary in the house tonight. Let's celebrate and congratulate a man that is very near and dear to my heart, Jack Davis.
And I'm an alcoholic. And Dina has 5 years tonight.